If you've raised or are raising children, you know that being a parent is arguably the most rewarding human endeavor you will ever experience. But when things go sideways, parenting can be devastating as well. The loss of a child is enough to cause even the most faithful among us to question God's purposes, and our questions multiply when we lose a child to suicide. Dealing with grief and finding God in the midst of life's toughest parenting challenges, today on License to Parent. Well, hello once again, and welcome to License to Parent, the radio outreach of Shepherd's Hill Academy, a year-long residential program for teens in crisis and for their families. Our host is the founder and director of Shepherd's Hill, Trace Embry, and I'm Rich Rossell. And Trace, today's program could get a bit heavy, but these things need to be discussed and dealt with from the standpoint of a biblical worldview, because this is very serious stuff, and these issues are very real. And if we as Christians are going to be held credible in the eyes of the world, no topic should be off limits, even the toughest ones.
I think that's exactly right, Rich. And, you know, there are a few things we want to talk about today. Mental illness, for one, is something that's really come to the forefront of discussion these days, especially in light of some of the recent shootings that we've been hearing about in the news.
Yeah.
Losing a child is another thing that not only affects parents, but siblings as well. I mean, my wife Beth and I, we know that from personal experience. And considering that, you know, America leads the world in teen suicide, we need to touch on these things. So, you know, it seems that everyone you talk to knows someone who's either taken their own life, lost a child, or know someone dealing with mental illness. My mom's side of my family has struggled with mental illness for as long as I can remember. And though suicide has never touched my family, two of my best friends have lost family members in that way, one a brother, one a father. But today we have a guest who's dealt with all these things up close and personal, and all while leading a high-profile ministry. I think she and her husband have handled their situation graciously and wisely, and I really look forward to hearing her insights on these issues.
Yeah, as do I. And one of the things that she has brought out in conversations with others is the fact that those of us who haven't gone through this personally often don't deal with the grief of those who have lost someone well at all. And we want to find out how, you know, how we can deal with it if it hits our lives, but also how we can come alongside those who are struggling with the results of a suicide. Our guest today is Kay Warren. Kay is the co-founder of Saddleback Church in Lake Forest, California, with her husband, Rick Warren. She is a passionate Bible teacher and a respected advocate for people living with mental illness, people who have been orphaned and who are vulnerable children, as well as, we might add, those living with HIV and AIDS. Kay even founded Saddleback's HIV and AIDS Initiative. She is the author of Choose Joy, Because Happiness Isn't Enough, Say Yes to God, and she is the co-author of Foundations, which is a popular systemic theology course used by churches worldwide. Her children are Amy and Josh and Matthew, who is now in heaven, and she also is a grandmother with five grandkids.
Okay, welcome to the License to Parent broadcast. It's an honor to have you on. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, for the sake of those who may not be familiar with your story, could you give us a little background of your experience with mental illness, bereavement, and your son Matthew's story?
Well, Matthew is our youngest, and I'm glad, because I think if he had been our first, Rick and I might have decided that maybe we weren't cut out to be parents, because from a really early age, Matthew was different and had temper tantrums that were unlike we had seen in our other two kids, and had a negative mood every single day from the time he was maybe one. I mean, very little boy, he was different.
Yeah.
And we just chalked it up to every child is unique,
sure,
and kept thinking he would outgrow it. And yet by the time he was seven, he was clinically depressed. We didn't even know children could be depressed. So it took us several months to realize that what he was experiencing was depression. He would come home every day from school and say he was sad, and he lost interest in his toys and his games and playing with other children. And but we didn't recognize those as being signs of depression. And from there, it felt like every few months, some other oddity would crop up. He had panic attacks and had a hard time playing sports because he would feel panicky. And by the time he was 12, he was diagnosed with early onset bipolar, and suicidal ideation crept in. And then as he grew, that got worse and worse. And by the time he was in his early 20s, he started declining mental health. He couldn't function. He couldn't stay in school. He couldn't hold down a job. He had difficulty in relationships. When he was 27, on April 5th, 2013, he hit that brick wall of mental illness for the last time, and he took his life. And in spite of all of the difficulties and the really tortured life that Matthew lived, he was funny and creative and kind-hearted, cared very much for hurting people, cared very much for vulnerable children. His heart was broken by the number of slaves that are still in the world, and the children and women and men sold into sexual slavery, and very, very tender-hearted. We called him a compassionate warrior. So we, as you said, I've been an advocate for people living with HIV and AIDS for, you know, more than a decade, and for orphans and vulnerable children. And my life was, I was very content with the ministry that God had given me, loved doing what I did. But when Matthew died, we were instantly thrust into a path that we would never have chosen, and advocacy that we didn't ever realize would be ours. But we know what it's like, you know, as you say, to have lost a child. To lose a child is one of the most difficult circumstances that can ever happen to anyone, and to lose a child to suicide is traumatic. It's catastrophic. There's the sense of, I remember feeling so many times, I'm never going to recover.
Yeah,
I will never recover from this. And over these 2.5 years since Matthew died, I can say that grief is the hardest work I've ever done.
Yeah.
I've never done anything harder in my whole life than to grieve this loss of our beloved son. And at the same time, which is the strange part, unless you know and love Jesus Christ, I am more hope-filled than I have ever been.
Sure. Kay, may I ask a question about, there are many of us who really can't comprehend what you and Rick have gone through, for example, or what others have gone through who've lost a child to suicide, or who have even lost a child. And I know Trace and Beth lost a child a number of years back. Help those of us who want to be compassionate, who want to be able to put our arms around you and minister to you. Give me some guidance here. I will be honest with you. When I go to any funeral, I never know what to say, even though I've lost my parents and whatnot. Help us through that.
Well, some of the things that people said that were actually very hurtful and not helpful at all were probably the worst offender is using the word at least. So anytime you find yourself trying to comfort a grieving person and you use the words at least, just know that you are minimizing their pain and you are minimizing their suffering and their loss, and you don't even know it. So when you say things like, well, at least you know he's in heaven. Mm-hmm. Well, at least you had him for 27 years.
Yeah.
To some of my friends, people said, well, at least you can have more children. Well, at least you can get married again.
Yeah.
Well, at least, and then we fill in with whatever we think is comforting, but it isn't. Because if somebody says, at least you had him 27 years, I want to say, but that wasn't long enough.
Yeah.
I wanted to have him his whole life. Somebody says, well, at least you know he's in heaven. Yes, I do. And that's the hope that gets me out of bed in the morning. But I wasn't ready.
Yeah,
I wasn't ready for him to be in heaven. I wanted to see him grow up and have children and get married and have a life. And I wanted to live with him and hear his laugh for so many more years. I wasn't ready for that. The most powerful, kind, compassionate thing that I think anybody can say to anyone who's lost someone is just, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Yeah.
It doesn't require any major answer. It doesn't require any explanation from the person who's grieving. It doesn't put them on the spot. It just acknowledges that you have said, I hurt with you, and you can't go wrong with
that. No, that's good. That's a good answer. I know Beth and I had people coming up to us saying, you know, well, if you only had enough faith, you know, your son lived, you know, he was 10 and a half months old. You must have some sin in your life, or, you know, you can always adopt these type of things.
Yeah.
How should we navigate those things? How do we respond to those when someone comes up and says something like that?
For those who are suffering the loss.
Yeah, you don't slap their ears back right there at the funeral.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say,
you might be forgiven if you did.
In my most gracious moments, I just smile and nod. Mm-hmm. And don't respond, and try to, in my heart, think of how they have a good intention. But when I was extremely raw, you know, before even that first year had passed and people were telling me, you know, in subtle and not so subtle ways that I needed to move on and I needed to turn the corner and all of those ridiculous things that people say who've never had deep loss, there were times I would just say, you know, that isn't really very helpful. I know you're trying, but that doesn't really help me.
I sometimes wanted to quote Jesus and just say, you know, as he said to his disciples one time, are you so dull?
Yeah.
How long do I have to put up with you?
Well, I think of Job's comforters, you know. They were perfect when they just came alongside Job and they sat with him for 7 days and seven nights in the silence. Mm-hmm. They just sat with him in his grief, because his grief was so enormous. They seemed to understand, at least in those 7 days, that they had nothing of any significance to say that was going to make it better for Job, but they just were with him.
Sure.
But it was when they opened their mouths and that they started, you know, making him feel guilty and, you know, it's your fault and, you know, come on, Job, fess up. You really know you did something here and it's, you know, this wouldn't have happened if you had been a better man or a better believer in God or something. And that wounds. That just adds layers of wounds to people who are suffering. Don't do it.
Yeah, sure. Kay, we also invited you on this program to talk about your book, Choose Joy, because happiness isn't enough. And other than mentioning the title, we haven't gotten there yet. So when we come back from our break, I want us to take a look into that book. Our guest today is Kay Warren, co-founder of Saddleback Church, wife of Rick Warren, author of Choose Joy, Because Happiness Isn't Enough. And we'll be back with more conversation with Kay right after this. You're listening to License to Parent.
Remember back in the late 80s and early 90s as the internet hit the scene? You know, the information superhighway? We had great hopes that this new knowledge economy would make our teens more aware, diversify their tastes, and improve their verbal skills. But the Enlightenment didn't happen. Technology has had the opposite effect. What once promised great hope for the future is now used to indulge in diversions. The Dumbest Generation by Mark Bauerlein, subtitled How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30, presents a portrait of the young American mind at this critical juncture, revealing the true cost of the digital age and our last chance to fix it. The Dumbest Generation by Mark Bauerlein, available in the store at LicenseToParent.org. Proceeds benefit the Shepherd's Hill Academy Scholarship Fund.
Hello, this is Dave Barton of Wall Builders. You know, history repeatedly validates the many benefits of an authentic biblical worldview. The Licensed to Parent radio broadcast helps restore that worldview back into the hearts and minds of today's parents, and Shepherd's Hill Academy successfully demonstrates that troubled teens and their parents can still experience the abundant life while being fully equipped to win back our culture to biblical truth. The Licensed to Parent broadcast teaches timeless biblical principles and answers that are lived out every day at Shepherd's Hill Academy. Both demonstrate that a biblical worldview provides guiding principles that work successfully every time they're applied.
With the generous gifts from people just like you, we're able to provide parents with practical insights to navigate the challenges families face in today's culture, as well as helping troubled teens in our year-long residential program. To learn more and to donate, visit LicenseToParent.org.
You're listening to Licensed to Parent, the radio outreach of Shepherd's Hill Academy. You'll find us online at licensedtoparent.org. And our guest today is Kay Warren, author of the book Choose Joy, Because Happiness Isn't Enough. And we've been talking about the journey that she and her husband, Rick Warren, have been going on since the death of their child, and her work in the field of mental illness and in dealing with suicide, and so many other great things, reaching out to those who are truly dealing with life's hardest issues.
Yeah. Okay, as you know, mental illness is not discriminate. Abraham Lincoln was no stranger to mental illness, no stranger to stress, grief. He even struggled from depression himself. He was quoted as saying, "I think a man is about as happy as he chooses to be." You wrote a book called Choose Joy. What's the difference between joy and happiness, and how does one actually choose either?
That was the question I asked myself for many years, because I've always lived with a pretty low level of depression, but pretty constant. I never even knew what to call it growing up. I just knew that there were periods of time in which I felt sad, in which I lost interest in, you know, school and friendships, and then after a few days it might pass. And so I just didn't even know that I was living with depression. But as Matthew's mental illness intensified as he grew into adulthood, I realized that there was just this big gap between what I read in the Bible about joy. You know, Paul, Peter, Jesus, David, I mean, so many people speak directly about joy at James. And then I would look at my life, and I looked around me at all the other Christians I knew. And while there were some extroverted, kind of bubbly people that seemed to always have an optimistic attitude, I just didn't see many people living with the kind of joy that it was apparently supposed to be mine, according to the Bible. And when Matthew just kept getting worse and worse, I realized that my spiritual life was not going to be able to sustain it if something really bad happened to him, that I was going to need joy, and I didn't have it, and I didn't know where to get it. And I had sort of decided that possibly it was just something for the Bible and really didn't have anything to do with real life. So I just dug in and read all the verses through the Bible about joy and joyful, happiness, mirth, all those words that were connected. And I came to the realization, I wasn't the first to realize this, but it became clear to me that joy truly had nothing to do with the external circumstances of my life.
Right.
And that even if my worst nightmare came true, even if Matthew did end up taking his life, that God told me that joy was still something within my reach, and I wanted that desperately. And as I began to continue in this study, I saw that it had everything to do with God and the fact that he is unchangeable and unshakable, that he's not going anywhere, that he truly is my rock and my fortress and my shelter in the time of storm, and that because he was so constant, that anything that happened to me externally couldn't touch that confidence in his love and his care for me that I was building on the inside.
Yeah.
And so I started framing it as when I can connect the internal to the eternal, which is God, then what happens on the external isn't going to affect how I feel and that sense of well-being. So I was defining joy wrong. I thought it really had to do with feeling up and feeling, you know, bubbly, which was not my personality. Discovered it had nothing to do with that, but it had to do with this absolute certainty that God was in control of all the details of my life, that ultimately everything was going to be all right, not that bad things weren't going to happen, but that God had me, that God was in control, and that he could be counted on, and he would never leave me. And when those things became certainties to me, absolute, rock-solid certainties, joy was something I began to experience, because it didn't fluctuate based on anything that was going to go on outside of what was going on in my soul.
Yeah.
And so that's why I can say, even though Matthew has died, and I have lived through the worst day of my life, And I can say on that day, Rick and I chose joy. I was wearing a necklace that said, choose joy. And we looked at each other and we looked at that necklace and thought, how in the world can we choose joy on this day when our son has died? But it had, again, nothing to do with what was going on externally, but the fact that God was going to be with us in this most dark of times. And that's the difference between joy and happiness. Happiness comes, it's fleeting, it's there, and we love it when we have that sense of, oh, this is the best day of my life. I've just had the greatest day of my life. But it's also constant when the worst day of your life happens, and in all those in-between kind of average days. So that's the choosing part. It's choosing to build my life, my roots, my confidence deep into who God is. And that's why it can last no matter what happens.
Yeah. We tell our kids here at Shepherd's Hill that happiness is contingent upon happenings, and joy transcends all that.
I was just amazed looking at the timeline of this, though, Kay, because you were talking about dealing with the challenges that you were facing with Matthew, and this was prior to Matthew's death. You wrote this book, what, a year before his death?
And
And to think, you know, that wouldn't have happened had God not prompted you to dig in and, dive in and learn about this, I cannot imagine. You've got such a mature approach to choosing joy over, you know, the issues of happiness. I don't know how I would do if I were faced with the situation you were faced with, but I count it all joy that God led you down this path to write this book for yourself and for others prior to that. That to me is God's amazing timing.
Yeah, I felt that it was. I felt that it was his preparing my heart for what was ahead. And it gave me everything I needed. It gave me the platform and the foundation that I needed to go through what was going to happen. And the fact is, I don't know what's around the corner tomorrow.
You know,
I say I've lived the worst day of my life, and I certainly have lived the worst day of my life so far. But I don't know what's around any corner. None of us do. And to wait until we're facing some of those dark times in our lives to try to scramble and find some roots, it's hard. And so I always encourage people to send their roots down deep into God's love, into his word, into relationships, so that when, as Rick calls them, the rogue winds come at us, as they will, that root structure is already in place. It's already there to help keep us grounded, to keep us from being blown away by the stuff that happens. And God tells us clearly that our roots are to be sent deep into him.
Absolutely. Kay, you're in ministry. Why don't more church leaders work hand in hand with mental health professionals? Why don't the mental health professionals, once they get the client, still refer back to the pastor to where they can work in conjunction? Because I see mental illness as having a spiritual root. Our sin nature has every bad thing in the world.
Well, this whole world is broken.
Exactly.
Everything about
right.
us is broken. Our bodies are broken. Our minds are broken.
Yeah.
This world is broken. There's no doubt that the fall unleashed illness and sickness and brokenness into our existence.
Yeah.
But I love what you said about, you know, a collaboration, because that's exactly what needs to happen.
Right. The
medical community can care for a person with an illness, but the church can care for a person with an illness. And each of us do what we're called and do best.
Yeah.
And the church can care for the person, for the soul, for the for the individual, the humanity of a person who is affected by an illness. And the medical community can help with an illness and understand that there's still a person in there. And so the two together, we're whole beings. We're body, mind, and soul. We're not just a body. We're not just a mind. We're not just a spirit. And when things break on any level, it's going to affect the other levels. And likewise, when there is health, and healing in one part of our lives, it spills over into the other part. So yeah. A harmony between those two is a much better way to go than isolating the church over here, the medical community over there. We do much better in collaboration.
It's kind of like you approach the issue with one hand behind your back, and then you just switch hands. The pastors pass it on to the mental health workers. I think that's part of the success at Shepherd's Hill is where, you know, there's a clinical department here, and yet we're still working in conjunction with the spiritual issues of these kids and their families. And I think that's really what's bringing the healing, is the fact that we understand that the human experience is like a pie with a bunch of slices. You know, there's nutrition involved. I mean, there's the physical right. part of things, mental health, spiritual, on and on and on. It's a holistic type of thing. And I think we need to work arm in arm. And I think a lot of particularly secular therapists discount what we do. And I think that's a terrible mistake. Your thoughts?
Well, and we want to, part of what we see our calling here is to help educate church leaders, pastors and church leaders, mm-hmm. because most are not prepared adequately in seminary or Bible college to, they don't even really know how to recognize mental illness, let alone know what to do about it or what's the appropriate course of action. And so to encourage pastors and church leaders to learn about mental illness, to learn about what their role is, how they can help. And the thing is, this is who's calling them every day. You know, about 23% of our pastoral care calls at Saddleback have some way or some influence with mental illness. And so to recognize it, to know that, and to equip pastors and church leaders to do what they're already doing, but to equip them to do it in a better, more effective way is part of what we feel is something we're called to do.
Awesome. Well, Kay, thank you for helping us to cram about a 3-week conversation into a half hour. I didn't think we'd do it, but
we've just skimmed the edges here.
I know.
So just started. There's lots to say.
Yeah. Our guest today is Kay Warren. She is the co-founder with her husband, Rick Warren, of Saddleback Church. She's also the author of a book we've touched on briefly, Choose Joy, Because Happiness Isn't Enough. She's also mom to Amy, Josh, and to Matthew, whose suicide a couple of years ago has been central to today's conversation. You can find out more about Kay's work in bringing mental health issues to the forefront in our churches and find her books and other resources at kaywarren.com. Kay, thank you so much for taking time to be on Licensed to Parent.
Thank you for the invitation. God bless you.
God bless you too. And once again, the name of this program is Licensed to Parent. This is the radio outreach of Shepherd's Hill Academy, a year-long Christ-centered residential program for teens in crisis. You'll find us online at licensedtoparent.org. And if you think your teen could benefit from residential care, I encourage you, please contact us. We'd love to have a conversation with you and help you walk through the decision-making process to find out if residential care is right for you and your family. And if you'd like to reach out and help other families with teens in crisis, please contact us as well. As we've said before, it takes a lot of ministry partners willing to come alongside us financially and prayerfully to provide the help that these families need. Your support in any amount can go a long way, whether it's a one-time gift or perhaps a monthly commitment to Shepherd's Hill. And thanks in advance. And by the way, remember that your gifts are tax-deductible when you give securely online at licensedtoparent.org. Just click the donate button at licensedtoparent.org, not .com. For Trace Embry, I'm Rich Rosl. Thanks again for listening, and please make plans to join us again next week and once again renew your license to parent.
And remember, folks, if you don't train your children, somebody else will. God bless you. See you next time.